Welcome to Cairo Nights. It appears, finally, after a long winter wait, Chairman of the Board, Shade Peterson, is back.
Yes, glad to be back.
He was trapped.
Oh, yeah. Tell me about trapped.
At a ski resort.
No, in a bar.
Some sort of...
On Snoqualmie Pass.
Friendly avalanche. I've had those. They always seem to occur usually, though, on Fridays or Mondays,
yeah,
the friendly avalanches. They don't usually seem to occur on these nights.
Yeah, it
is. Of course,
is.
News boss Frank, yeah, that's who you're hearing. Piling on Shane, that is news boss Frank Shires, and I am Mike Lewis. This is, I'm particularly excited about this show because I get a chance to really, really go deep geek. It is going to be, tomorrow is touchdown for the Perseverance rover on Mars. And we are lucky in this area. The same way we're always lucky whenever we talk about anything regarding science is we've got so many of the leading minds in various things. And tonight we're having on the show at 8 o'clock a person who's actually a part, a lead part of the Mars rover team. He started with the original project 8 years ago, proposal on the project 8 years ago. It's University of Washington professor and physicist Tim Elam. Is joining us at 8 o'clock. He played a big role, and if you want to talk to someone who is preoccupied and nervous at this point, because they're going to send the last little bit of instructions to the Mars rover, and then, given the time lag, they have to wait and see whether or not it lands correctly, and it is a spectacular landing and a really interesting project. We also are going to have Scott Greenstone coming up in just a minute here. He is a reporter for the Seattle Times. He did a dynamite interview with the former director of homeless services here in Seattle. And the big question, of course, all of us have is we've spent a whole lot of money on this. Why are we not seeing any results? Or are there results that we're just not seeing? Really interesting question. We'll have him on in just another minute. And as a quick wrap up, look to Texas if you want to see one of the worst stories in the country right now. The storm has left millions of people without power for days on end. Go onto Reddit and look at Texas pictures. People with frozen toilets, burst pipes in their ceiling that have then frozen after they have burst. This is a rolling disaster. Unfortunately, the blackouts aren't rolling. They're permanent, or at least permanent over the last few days. It has been an abysmal situation down in Texas. We talked about it a bunch yesterday. We'll be talking about it again tomorrow, maybe even later in the show if we get a chance to. But right now, we've got Scott on the phone, Scott Greenstone on the phone from the Seattle Times to talk about, of course, about Seattle's homeless situation.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Scott, I read your story with a tremendous amount of interest because I think the perception is, I think broadly, that we're spending a ton and we're not seeing the needle move a whole lot. And I don't know that that's always been a fair perception. You've looked at this more closely than most. Before we get into the specifics, because you managed to get a guy who's been a little bit enigmatic here in Seattle, the former leader of the Seattle Human Services Department, Jason Johnson, sat down with you. Now, he's left the job, but he was famously reticent about talking to the press when he actually was the director of all these homeless services. So when you look at it, does it appear to you that the public concern about the spend versus the outcome is a legitimate one?
That's a good question. I think it's very fair to say, okay, look, in the last 3 years, we've seen, this was my first question to Jason, we've seen, you know, when he started, the yearly budget was over $80 million. The first question I asked Jason was, you know, when he started in 2018, the budget was under $90 million for homelessness, and now it's $165 million for 2021. And, of course, the problem obviously has not gotten better. So I think it's a legitimate one. I don't think there's a lot of discussion out there about when we're funding fixes versus funding like survival services. So a lot of that money went toward making our shelters better. You know, most of our shelters in Seattle used to be just overnight. You get kicked out in the morning and you're sleeping on a mat on the ground. And what Seattle tried to do was make it so that you can stay there longer, maybe all day if you need to, and rest up. You could store your stuff there, you know, look for a job, different things like that. That costs a lot more money. But I think at the same time, we're talking about really big issues here that are much bigger than whether or not you build a shelter or make a shelter better, right? We're talking about issues of serious mental illness. We're talking about issues of affordable housing and all the cheap, really cheap housing where people, you know, who lived on the lowest end of the earning spectrum used to live. That, you know, that's all gone around here, too. So we're talking about, like, huge economic, like, I guess, like plate movements, right? Like giant shifts and waves. But you're trying to sort of fix them with this little bucket of money, and you're saying, okay, let's build a homeless shelter, or let's make it better.
Right, right. And so when you're that's such an interesting point. And one of the things that I've thought about in looking at this problem as well is that it appeared like while the city is getting more expensive, while the homeless population is rising, both as a result, like you said, of perhaps a national pandemic in opioid addiction, mental health crises, and we're not funding that sufficiently. And then the other thing that happened, and I think a lot of people sometimes miss this, is that all of those, you know, SROs, all those single residency occupancy, old yeah. sort of former hotels, there used to be quite a few of them in Seattle. They all went away to underdevelopment. They've become, I mean, the famous yeah. one would be the Publix, say, on the edge of International District. That used to be one of those places, and all of those like cheap short-term rentals, flop houses, if you will, all went away.
Sure.
At the same time, the rest of these things happen. I mean, is that a fair defense of anyone who would be in charge of the homelessness programs here in Seattle?
It's such a good point that you bring up, and it's one that people miss a lot, because when we say, oh, affordable housing and the lack of it has caused the homeless crisis, a lot of people look out at the people staying on the sidewalks and they're like, well, that person doesn't seem like they would be able to pay rent. But, you know, 20 years ago, they probably would, because there would have been a really, really cheap place, a flop house, a single room occupancy hotel, an extended stay motel, just like what you're talking about, right? There would have been a spot for them, right? And those spots are gone now. And we're trying to build them back, but we're building them back institutionally with, you know, I mean, you don't want to bring back a place like the spot you mentioned, or I'm thinking about the famous one that burned down in 1971. The name of it is escaping me right now, but it was in South Lake Union, obviously in the middle of where Amazon is today. And you know, it was a fire trap, and it burned down. And after that, the fire department said, we got to start closing down these single room occupancy hotels. They are unsafe. So you can't build back extra cheap places like that again. So what we're doing is we're building back these sort of institutional, less cheap, much more expensive places called, you know, permanent supportive housing, right? The Morrison Hotel is a great example of this.
Right.
Used to be, you know, and especially now that it's sitting empty, other than the folks who live. So there was a shelter on the first floor, and then on the third, fourth, and fifth floors, there are little single room occupancy rooms. But there's also mental health clinicians there. There's substance use disorder counselors there, right? Like, that's expensive. That costs a lot of money. And most of the money that we as a region spend on homelessness actually goes to things like that.
So when you were speaking with Mr. Johnson, one of the things that struck me is he was always really reticent about talking to reporters. Mm-hmm. He wasn't always forthcoming when he did. I would say that you did, you know, heroic work trying to get answers out of him for your piece, but it still felt to me like he was not actually addressing it in cases the real primary points. And you raise a really good question here when you talk about the $165 million spent that, and I'm just going to read from your question, correct me if I'm wrong, but very little of that, or maybe none of it, goes to actual housing. It's mostly services. Now, my impression was that we were actually spending money to some degree on housing. Where does that actually, I mean, are we just doing triage at this point, or are we actually doing really moving people into some sort of housing?
That's a great question. People point to that $165 million. I did all the time. And it is correct. Very little of that went to doing anything except for some of it went to like retrofitting a shelter or, you know, creating an emergency shelter, right? Like the one in Soto during the smoke, when the smoke was kind of filling the air and right. We had to get homeless folks inside. How do I say this? We are spending a lot of money building housing. In fact, we are spending a record amount of money building housing, but that housing isn't going to open for a while. I mean, it takes a long time, especially in Seattle,
right.
To get anything approved and built up. And I think there have been efforts to build it faster. You know, Councilmember Andrew Lewis, the Seattle City Council member who represents some of downtown in Magnolia, he and a few others from this coalition of businesses and homeless advocates called the Third Door Coalition, they've been working on, okay, how can we use construction technology, lifting some regulations that slow down construction to like build this housing as fast as possible. But the thing is that the federal government used to pay for building this type of housing. And now, I mean, at least for the last couple of administrations, the federal government has not been doing that. You know, they have not been building more public housing, for better or worse. There were definitely a lot of public housing complexes that, you know, weren't in great condition either. So for the federal government to step back and say, we're not building this stuff anymore, I mean, they just have way more money than the local government does. So it's like we're trying to plug a hole in a big seawall, right? But the water is coming over the top.
right. That makes complete sense. We're talking with Scott Greenstone. He is a Seattle Times reporter. His story on Seattle's former homelessness director, and he was very reticent about being interviewed, was finally interviewed about where we're at right now and why doesn't it feel like we're making any headway. Scott, so when you sat down and talked with him, and I was, again, surprised that he gave the interview at all, what do you feel like he answered in a manner that actually sort of deepened your understanding, and what do you feel like he talked around from the issues that you folks brought up or that you brought up with him?
This is, yeah, I was really interested in his answer about nonprofits who maybe misuse public funding. You know, there's a strong sense, I think, among many readers and listeners, you know, to the news who kind of dig into this issue, they wonder, you know, are nonprofits using our money well? There's a lot of nonprofits taking a lot of money from, or a good amount of money from the government, and the problem, of course, is not getting better. So I wanted to ask him about his, you know, impression of that, because he was the guy who was supposed to pay attention to which nonprofits were spending the money well and which were not, you know. So I asked him about that. And I think his answer encapsulates both of the questions that you were asking. You know, first of all, he said, yes, often it will happen that we will send out a request for proposals, right? Part of the standard bidding process. We'll say we want to build a new shelter, or we want to, you know, enhance, get better shelters, you know, send us your proposals, and they'll pick the best one, right? Or they will try to defund a program. But they will say, you know what, your program has not been doing very well. Your shelter has not been doing very well as far as getting people into housing. We're not going to fund it anymore. When that happens, those organizations, some of them that are well-connected, will go to their connections within city council, and they will say, hey, we just got defunded by the city. You're on city council. Can you get us funded in this budget? You have control of the budget, or you at least can influence it. Can you get us, you know, funded again? So that I felt was upfront. However, then I asked him, can you give me an example of that? Give me an organization. And he pointed to what I felt is a very easy organization to point out, which is this group called ShareWheel.
Right.
They run these shelters, and they have for years. They're a group of activists who run these shelters in Seattle, but they run them at a very low cost. And I will say, they don't have good data. They're very unwilling to share data. They don't get a lot of people into housing, but they're also very cheap. I think, inarguably, the cheapest shelter option you can get, because they ask homeless folks to help run the shelter. When you enroll in a share shelter, they say, okay, you can sleep here, and you got to do a security shift, or you got to clean, or you got to do something, you know? And so you have to help run this shelter. And so they're very cheap shelters. Now, that organization is a very easy target. What I really wanted to know, and what I think he may have talked around, was what about the bigger organizations, you know? Right. What about the ones that take a lot more money? Because these folks are running really cheap shelters, and their connection on the council is City Council Member Kashama Sawant, who, you know, is also kind of an activist and also an easy target. But what about other, you know, nonprofits? And, of course, part of my work with Project Homeless on the Seattle Times, which is the Seattle Times kind of effort to examine what is causing this persistent homelessness crisis and what can fix it, is to look into some of these you know, some of the efforts that are not working so well. It's tough to try and call a nonprofit to account, because I do think that most people who work at nonprofits are well-intentioned, and many of them are underpaid. But sometimes, you know, when you've been doing the same thing for 10 or 15 years, you know, you need to innovate and change things. And a lot of people right now are saying, you know what, shelters don't work. We need to move beyond shelters. What can we do to try and actually fix this problem? Let's stop doing the same thing we've been doing. I hope that makes sense.
Absolutely. So we're talking to Scott Greenstone, Seattle Times reporter. We worked on, I should have mentioned this earlier, the Project Homeless project for the Seattle Times, which is this ongoing look at what is effective and what is ineffective in the effort to battle homelessness in Seattle. Scott, let me ask one sort of broad question for somebody who's been looking at this for a long time. Does the homelessness problem sometimes suffer with that whole adage about perfection being the enemy of progress? In other words, we're always looking for the ideal solution rather than solutions that at least start moving things forward? Or is that not maybe a fair assessment?
Oh, man, that's a good question. That's not one that gets asked enough. Yeah, I agree with what you're saying. You know, the good is not always the enemy of the best. And I think that you're right. You know, I was thinking of a study that came out of, I believe it was Stanford a few years ago, and it looked at the number of shelter beds that cities had, and it found that over the years, if a city built more shelter, it would actually then need more shelter later on. And so, yes, you know, congregate shelters are bad. Yes, congregate shelters are
flawed.
Yes, congregate shelters are, you know, they're good for survival, right? When you put someone on a mat on the ground, they're going to live that night where they might not have if it's snowing outside, right?
Right.
But at the same time, you know, you can't really sleep in a shelter. I've talked to many folks that are woken up in the middle of the night by someone yelling, or, you know, you may not feel safe in a shelter. There are often folks doing drugs and things like that. So I think that survival services, if you only invest a little bit, I think you may see that the problem tends to get worse because the causes are so much bigger than what you're investing, right? If you invest enough to try and fix the problem, you know, I think that you put in a little bit more on the front end. I think that you then save yourself money on the back end. You know, a good example of this is 1811 Eastlake downtown, which was this housing that was really controversial at the time. It was called wet housing.
Wet housing, for the habitual alcoholics, right?
Exactly. And so we gave rooms to alcoholic folks who were living out on the streets. And what we actually found is that we saved money because they weren't getting 911 called on them so much. They weren't getting taken in an ambulance to the hospital, things like that. So that expensive upfront amount that we paid, we actually saved money in the end because we kind of sort of fixed the problem,
right?
Or at least we applied a pretty hefty Band-Aid, right?
Right.
We fixed one big chunk of that problem, maybe not the whole problem, but certainly enough to save us some money. I don't know if that answers your question.
No, absolutely it does. That was Scott Greenstone. He is a Seattle Times reporter on Project Homelessness. His story on Seattle's former homeless director on why we spend so much without a fix. And it was heroic work to try and squeeze that answer out of him. Scott, thank you for joining Cairo Nights.
Thank you so much, Mike. Anytime.
More Cairo Nights coming up right after the break. Stay tuned.
You can ring my bell.
Welcome back to Cairo Nights. One of the things that's taken a big turn for a variety of reasons this year, in fact, it happened to my niece as well, is the whole wedding business, from weddings being canceled to ending up on Zoom to people changing what they want. Rachel's here with a story about how much it's changed and how people have pivoted to a new style of wedding.
Yeah, so 80% of people either postponed or canceled their wedding in the U.S. But the people who are getting married are shifting the money that they're spending to different arenas. So in 2019, the average wedding cost $25,000. I mean, no matter what year it is, and I read whatever the statistic is, I always blanch and I cannot understand how people spend this much money. But anyway, since people are not renting a big venue or catering a big event, or, you know, a lot of people are scaling back on what they're spending for wedding dresses, all of those things, it seems that they're putting the money into diamonds. So before this year, 1-carat stones were the most popular. This year, 2.5 carat diamonds became more popular. I would have thought if people weren't spending all of the money on the big wedding, they would either A, save it for the reception they're probably planning to have next year, or B, you know, spend it on a honeymoon or put it into a mortgage. I was surprised to read that people are like, well, there's extra money. I want a bigger diamond. And that even extends into the men. They said men are opting for diamonds in their bands more than they have in years past. So I thought that was kind of interesting. And then there's a couple of other places where people are kind of shifting. Like if you do have a small wedding, instead of having a big tiered cake that you can't get rid of because there's not enough people to eat it, they're doing these little kind of individual desserts like macarons or individual kind of ice cream kind of pops. They're doing individual charcuterie plates. And then instead of hiring a band or a DJ, they're doing bingo and trivia games to keep people engaged.
Wow. So the interesting thing about this, I mean, that occurred to me when I was reading this story is that your impression of what weddings are like are really an impression of what your cohort is like, right? Your friends, because you go to a really specific subset of people for weddings. I mean, the weddings that we will go to, I mean, I don't know how many weddings I've been to at this point in my life, maybe 25, 20, something like that. And I was seeing exactly, at least among my friends here in Seattle, and maybe Seattle is a particular subset, I was seeing a movement the other way. I haven't been to a lot of elaborate weddings here, and I've seen pretty modest, from attire to pretty modest, you know, titanium rings or something along those lines. I've not seen this trend at all. Have you?
I think that we have different friends than these $25,000 wedding people.
Well, but that's my point. It's like your friends are an example of your cohort, right?
Yeah, exactly. Because even my friends who live in other parts of the country, I think I've been to one or two weddings that probably cost a lot of money. But my favorite wedding I've ever been to was a camping wedding where they rented out the whole campsite. The bride still wore a beautiful gown. He still wore a tuxedo, but they got married in the campsite. And, you know, the food was catered by a local pie company and a barbecue company. So this kind of wedding is just different than I am used to. But I recognize that I think the people that I hang out with are not the average American and don't share the same values.
Well, and they certainly aren't the people who have built a giant wedding industry, right? Because they're just not spending that same money. And I'm kind of there with you. I don't understand. I mean, if I were getting married to somebody who it was the end all be all to have a 2-carat diamond, yeah, I'd find a way to get one. But it just doesn't feel to me like time, like in diamonds in particular, don't feel to me like, wow, I'd rather spend that money on a great vacation with that person. Or if we already had one, then just like throw it into charity or something like that. It seems like such an odd accoutrement to spend that much money on.
I actually don't know what 1-carat looks like or 2-carat. So I don't even know how big or small those rings are. So this kind of, I probably should have Googled that before we did this because it's kind of meaningless to me. But yeah, it's interesting because I'm assuming that people who are getting married during the pandemic plan to have their big party when this is all over. So maybe they think that, oh, within a year, then I can, you know, make that money back and we can still afford to have that party. But it's interesting. I went to one Zoom wedding and I hated it because you know, you're not with your friends. You're not in the place where your friend getting married is. And the ceremony was only 10, 15 minutes, and they didn't have it mic'd super well. I couldn't hear what they were saying half the time. And then I closed my laptop and didn't get to hang out with anybody. I found it quite depressing to be wearing. I wore a gown in my living room by myself. But a friend of mine said something that I thought was really powerful, which is people who get married during the pandemic are getting married for the marriage, not the wedding. I think there's a lot of people who get caught up in the party, which is really fun. And a lot of spending a lot of money on the party is being showy and showing people that you have money or trying to impress people. So I'm curious to see if there's any way to keep track and if they're going to keep any records of, like, you know, the divorce rate of people who get married at the year of the pandemic, because I wonder if it's true, if the people who've gotten married really are doing it because they just finally want to be wed and they don't really care about it being a showy event.
You know, I think that that's a portion of it, but I also think there's a portion of people who are maybe worried about older relatives and they're rushing it ahead to make sure it happens before their older relatives maybe get infected or perhaps even die from it. I mean, I know that that's been the case in two weddings that I'm familiar with, that people moved it ahead very quickly because they were very concerned about older relatives. Now we are seeing much greater survival rate, but early on, people were pretty worried about that. So it would be, I think you're right, it would be interesting to see how those things play out. The funny thing about the wedding was, so years ago, I helped out at a friend's wedding. He was working for us in the bar as a bartender, and he and his wife were getting married, and the bartender, who he had known for a long time, Vietnam vet who had moved back to Vietnam at this point, couldn't attend because he didn't want to come back to the United States. He loved where he was, but we figured out a way to get, we got him a laptop before he left. We did all this stuff, trained him on how to use Skype, and we brought him to the wedding, sort of an early version of a Zoom meeting, except he was the only person doing it as a meeting. The best part about it was that we put the laptop up at the side of the altar so he could look at the couple and see the crowd. But what he didn't realize was that everyone in the church was looking back at him. And so you see him watching the wedding, and he seems to be totally delighted by it. He's a guy in his middle to late 60s at this point. And then suddenly you see a Heineken come up, and he's like, he's getting drunk during the wedding. And people in the is a Catholic wedding start laughing, and he can't figure out why everyone is laughing because he doesn't realize that everyone is looking right at him as he is looking at the couple. It turned out to be a fantastic element to the wedding. And then we brought him to the reception, and people sat down in a chair just all to say hello to him when he was there as well. So, but that's a different thing.
He's like a viral star at that wedding.
He was Max Headroom of the wedding. Yes, exactly. Well, I don't know. I think it's kind of interesting. I'm really surprised that. I would have expected weddings to move the other direction, not that way. But I don't know.
Well, it's just like another testament to just how adaptable and adjustable humans are. And in this country, especially where entrepreneurship is such a big deal as an American, that everything that has shifted. I mean, in this article, they were talking about the fact that, of course, you know, photographers and videographers were completely out of work and after March because all the weddings were canceled. But the smart people shifted. And so they tell a story of a photographer who now, you know, can provide a live streaming service. It starts at $850. And instead of like the wedding I went to, where I couldn't hear what they were saying and there were no good shots of the bride and groom, he is, you know, using high speed routers and modems and wireless radios and miking everybody and using high quality cameras so it can be recorded. And, you know, they're talking about wedding shops adapting and selling shorter, less expensive dresses because people having these small weddings just want a low-key, simple dress. So it's funny how fast it shifts. They were talking about, you know, selling these masks that are as cheap as $2, but they're satin and velvet and lace and beaded to go with your bridal gown. I mean, it doesn't take long for people in this country to adjust and also manufacture things that work for their needs.
Yeah, I mean, we've watched all of the companies that do sort of events and whatnot, they've all pivoted, and these companies have gotten very sophisticated. I mean, you can do a pretty good job with a virtual event now that seems to be at least as good as it's going to be if you are not actually there. Rachel, thank you so much for the story.
Thank you.
Coming up on Cairo Nights at the top of the hour, we are going to take a deep dive, or maybe a distance dive, into the Mars lander, the rover, which is going to be going in. Its rover has a helicopter. This is I Geek Out on This Stuff, something seriously. We have got an expert who has participated in the project, in one of the other projects, rather, from the University of Washington. That is at 8 o'clock. Please stay tuned. So, in the next segment, we're going to have a professor from Tim Elam from the University of Washington. He's a physicist and one of the lead project managers for the Perseverance rover. And his specialty, he'll talk about his specialty, but essentially it involves analysis of soil and rock samples. Actually, collecting the data that can then be analyzed by the geologists. And I'll get into that in a minute. But there's all kinds of other things and all very discreet. It's like a whole bunch of people all had their own project that they had to manage and all managed to get it in this multi-billion dollar rover to get onto Mars. And here's one of the cooler ones. So we've got that. That's a University of Washington physicist is, of course, you know, there's nothing outside the realm of likelihood in that. I mean, it's a very difficult project to get involved with. And obviously, Professor Elam is thrilled to be involved. I mean, this is a real dream for him. But there's all kinds of other people who get involved in this stuff. And here's one of the odd stories just before we get into the story with Professor Elam. This is involved a Los Angeles musician. This is a dynamite story out of Wired magazine. In L.A., the headline is an L.A. musician who helped design a microphone for Mars. And this is the subhead is how an obsession with space led to a partnership on the Perseverance rover and the chance we could finally hear what our planetary neighbor sounds like. And it turns out this guy, he's a really accomplished Berkeley School, actually University of Berkeley, not Berkeley Performing Arts School. He is a graduate of that school. He actually went to De Anza Community College first and then managed to get in. He's a really gifted musician. And he does a lot of session work in Los Angeles. He also records and produces for a variety of bands down there. And he's talking with a buddy. He's sitting on the porch talking with a buddy. This guy's name is Jason Achilles Mazilis. And he is he's talking with a buddy. They're sitting on a porch, and his buddy works for Jet Propulsion Laboratory, people who are heavily involved in the Mars rover. And he says, hey, you know, because this guy is a, you know, the guitarist is a sound guy, and he's obsessed with microphones and sounds and producing sounds. And he says, well, what if we got a microphone on that thing? And would that be possible? I mean, is it a crazy idea? It turned out, and he made the suggestion years ago, it turns out that NASA was thinking the same thing, that why don't we put a microphone on this and we can listen to what the ambient noise is on Mars when we get down there. So the way they describe Mazilis is a youthful 46-year-old with an unruly mop top, and he was something of a late bloomer as a musician. He didn't even start playing music until he was a senior in high school, but he started playing the guitar obsessively, which caused his grades to drop, and then he didn't get into a good school. So he went to a community college, De Anza Community College in the Bay Area. I went to school not far from De Anza. And managed to get with a teacher who really got him squared away on music, and it still became his obsession, and then managed to get into UC Berkeley in the music department. And as on the backstory of him is he had spent his entire life kind of obsessed with outer space and the space program, and he always thought how cool it would be to get involved, but his area was music, so there's really no way to do anything like that. So his friend mentions it to one of the project directors at NASA. NASA, out of the blue, calls him back. This is months after he had made the suggestion. And they said, well, yeah, well, let's see your plan for a mic. And he actually didn't have a plan. He just had an idea. So he raced and got his plan together. And it turns out that NASA really liked what he had to say and what he had to offer about how you would build a very specific mic for this application. He gets on the horn with JPL, big electronics company, and they actually hatch a plan to build a very specific mic for this application. And it's going to be part of one of the big instruments on the main Mars rover. Their idea managed to get them a $650,000 grant to develop the prototype for this microphone. And they managed to get the deal. And so what's going to happen? Well, tomorrow, Mazilis is going to be listening to his own work on Mars when the Mars rover touches down and then begins its work. Now, I mean, everyone right now, the professor we'll be talking with in the next segment, all of them myself included, are going to be just on pins and needles until this thing lands successfully and starts on its mission. It's an enormously complicated thing to do. But I got to say, not only am I excited about it for myself, because I've always been sort of a fan of anything involving a space program, I am also a fan of these people who do these small, little-known projects and get to be a part of a big team like this. That, to me, is fantastic. All right, you know what's coming up. A little bit more Mars Rover talk. You got to listen to this section, because this is somebody who is intimately involved in the project, has been for 8 years, and is very excited to see his work literally take off on the surface of Mars. Coming up right after the break.